Good evening, everyone. We are continuing our series in which we are studying the Restoration Movement. And tonight we're going to begin to pull all of the threads together, and especially as we talk about the Restoration Movement in America. I want to tell you that I'm kind of painting with a broad brush and kind of pulling a lot of things together that came from some classes that I've taken and some research that I have done. And if there are some people that we end up talking about that pique your interest, I want to encourage you to pick up a volume such as this. This is The Search for the Ancient Order, A History of the Restoration Movement. It comes in four volumes. My daughter bought me volume one. I haven't bought the other three volumes because they're about $25 a piece. So, you know, they're not something you pick up easily. But if there are some people whose names that we talk about that come up, I encourage you to maybe borrow this from me after we get through with this series and do some reading on your own. The internet's also a good source. There are a couple of good websites that are devoted to restoration history. There's a couple of websites that are maintained by our brotherhood. Lipscomb, I think, has one in Albany. They've got almost all of the writings of some of these pioneer preachers in digital format, and you can actually look at them online and read them online and things like that. Now, if you don't have a computer, that's a little bit of a problem, but the public library has computers that you can use if you really want to do some research as well. But one of the things we want to do is we want to go back and pick up some of the threads that we have noticed so far and then bring ourselves down into America, because America is the place where the Restoration Movement really took root. Although we're going to notice that there, not tonight, but we will notice next week, there are some ties to Scotland. Scotland is also a source of one of the great places where this type of thinking really began to take root. But we go all the way back to pick up our threads back to the Renaissance. This movement, the Renaissance, was a movement of transition in Europe from medieval to modern times. It was after the Dark Ages, and this was the time period when man began to rediscover classical literature and classical arts and letters. And there were people we know of by name that really make a mark in this time period. People like Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael. And in this time period, between the 1400s and the 1600s or 1700s, you have a return to Greek literature, you had a return to the classic way of thinking, you had the common man becoming educated, you had literacy beginning to abound. Prior to this, the Catholic Church had pretty much, through controlling the aristocracy, had also pretty much controlled Christianity and the common man. And the common man, prior to this, was not allowed to read, was not allowed to be educated, was not allowed copies of the Bible. Nobody had access to the Bible. Everybody depended upon the Catholic Church. But during this Renaissance, which soon spread to Germany and England, and we've seen people like Wycliffe and Martin Luther, we've talked about them, we saw that it began to affect all kinds of areas of society, and especially in the idea of study and learning. And students of science and philosophy and religion started looking for the sources of their things, and they began looking at original documents. And when they did that, they had a rediscovery of the Bible in the hands of everyday man. Remember, people like Wycliffe and Martin Luther advocated, we need to get this out of the hands of clergy, into the hands of modern man, into the hands of everyday man, so that they could read the Bible for themselves. And that was a key thought in all of this that began really and led to some of the things that happened that we call the Restoration Movement. In fact, these two fundamental principles appeared out of this time period. Number one was the right of private judgment. In other words, every single person has the right to make up his own mind. By the way, that we see this right of private judgment being talked about in our Declaration of Independence as one of the unalienable rights, a right that is given to us by God, God Himself, something that cannot be taken away from anybody or by anybody, by government, by any force, even religion, cannot take away our right to make private judgments, to decide things for ourselves. Another thing that came up was that they began to understand that the Bible, particularly the New Testament, talked a great deal about unity. And especially as we began to have Martin Luther, Wycliffe and the others and the Reformation movement going on and the development of Protestants and versus Catholics, people who began to read the Bible for themselves would turn to places like John chapter 17, where Jesus prays for unity and tells people that this is how they will know that He really did come into the world, that they might be one. They began to realize that the Bible would produce unity if people would follow just the Bible and not follow mankind, not follow religious doctrine. And so they looked at John 17, verses 11 to 23, and they realized that Jesus Himself said unity was not only possible, but really was commanded. And yet, the result of looking at scriptures that talk about unity and everything, was finding out that the churches in their day were far from the will of God, and they were far from this attitude that would promote unity by going to the Bible. And in fact, the church was indeed divided. The church, as they talked about it, now included Protestants and Catholics, and what we would call the restoration of the first century church really had not yet occurred. But they saw such divisions as weakening the forces of God. And instead of one force for God, there were many small detachments, jealously watching each other rather than the common foe. And because of that, there's a warring church. And churches were literally devouring one another. They saw that there were wars going on. And in fact, the wars that were going on between Protestants and Catholics specifically led to a great many people fleeing and to the Americas, trying to find religious freedom. You have the Pilgrims, you have the Quakers, you have all of those people coming over. But of course, the Protestant churches were looked upon as physical enemies of the Roman Church. And you had the Roman Church in places like Spain instituting the Inquisition. You had all kinds of things going on in which people were trying their best to stamp out this protest to the Roman Catholic Church. And public displays of rhetorical hatred were really spouted forth from pulpits and in pamphlets and things like that everywhere. And there were actual physical engagement and wars that were often resulted between the fighting forces. This even came over spilled over into the Americas, because in the Americas the Anglican Church, the Church of England, followed and tried to put its stamp on the religion that was practiced in America. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment, just a little bit more detail. But they knew, because Jesus had taught, Matthew 12, a house divided cannot stand. And they knew that there was a problem when there's these kinds of wars going on in the name of Christ against one another. And so they began to look for a source. And this is some of the threads that we're pulling together. And they saw that the theology was really being taught was really awful.
It was literally the blind leading the blind and both falling into the ditch, borrowing a paraphrase from Matthew 15 and verse 14. And many people really began to understand that the Bible was not understood as a systematic revelation from God, but many people thought of the Bible simply as a jumble of jewels thrown together, and one aspect of it didn't relate to another aspect of it, and they could pick and choose what they wanted. By the way, that way of thinking is still pretty prevalent among a vast majority of people in the world who really have not taken the time to understand how the Bible is laid out and how the Bible can be understood. But during this time period, there were people who were beginning to understand the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. They were beginning to understand how the Old Testament became the foundation for the New Testament and what Jesus came to do. And a system began to be put into play where people could really apply just common sense rules of understanding and begin to understand what the Bible said. But they had an arrogant clergy. Remember, clergy had been developed not in accord with the Bible, but clergy, and we saw in our study from the book of Revelation where the thought of clergy came from. It was the idea of having someone telling you what to believe. But during this time period, most men of the clergy were very ignorant concerning the Bible, ignorant concerning almost anything and everything, and ignorance bred a kind of arrogance. How dare you say that I'm ignorant? How dare you point out that I don't know these things because I am clergy? I am closer to God than you are, is what they were saying. And so the Bible had been removed from access to the common man, enlarging the schism or the chasm between the common man and clergy. And this arrogant clergy, from both Protestant and Anglican and Roman Catholic points of view, the common man began to have this thought as they began studying the Bible for themselves. The common man, by the time, especially around the time of the founding of America, had this idea. Israel could not be restored to God without removing idolatry in the Old Testament. Christianity cannot be restored without removing the modern clergy. And that was one of the things, believe it or not, that was prevalent during the time frame of the founding of America. That's why I talked about the founding of America as being one of the great catalysts for the restoration movement. If America had not been founded, I think that we would have maybe have not seen the restoration principles put into play as soon as we did in the Americas. So this is where the American Revolution played a pivotal role. For clergy was tied to government. For instance, you know, we don't seem to remember that the tyranny of George III of England was just as much religious as it was political. We don't seem to remember that England thought it was logical for her to bring her view of religion to the New World as well as her politics. And in fact, remember, the only difference really between the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and the Roman Catholic Church was the fact that the King of England had proclaimed himself to be the head of the church. Now think about that. As in the pre-Revolutionary War era or days, the most well-known and well-funded and well-staffed church in America was what they called the Established Church, or the Church of England, the Anglican Church. All other groups were looked upon with great disfavor and suffered great persecution in one form or another because people were not worshiping as Anglicans or as members of the Church of England in the colonies of England.
And see, the clergy of the, what was, see, in America was called the established church. And in the clergy of the established church, they ruled the affairs of the colonies with an iron hand. For instance, an assembly was held in March of 1624 in Virginia that came as a directive of the King of England that provided that all must attend divine services on Sunday. All who are subjects to the king must attend divine services on Sunday. Whoever missed once without an allowable excuse was fined £1 of coffee. All right? Now keep in mind, there were other religious groups over here. People had fled to the Americas for religious freedom. But in the colonies, you had to, if you were going to be a good citizen of the colonies, you had to attend the established church, the Church of England. And if you did not attend the Church of England, you may have attended somewhere else, but if you didn't attend the Church of England, you would be fined. And a month's missing would cause you a fine of £50. £50. Every person was told to conform to the canons of England and to yield ready obedience to them under pain of censure. Fact is, in the colonies that were devoted to the raising of tobacco, no man was allowed to sell his tobacco until the clergyman of the local established church, the Church of England, gave permission. Each year at the tobacco harvest, a man was appointed to visit each plantation to collect the local clergyman's of the Church of England's portion out of the first and best tobacco. By 1632, the laws were revised to some extent, but contained the same spirit. Non-attendance at services now cost the guilty party 1 shilling instead of a pound of coffee. All right? But in the main, you begin to see that was the role of the clergyman in America. Their role was to hunt for and punish heresy. Heresy against the Church of England. There was an act passed by England that's called the Act of Uniformity, which was enacted to preserve the purity of doctrine and unity of the Church, that all ministers whatsoever which shall reside in the colony are to be conformable to the orders and constitution of the Church of England and the laws therein established, and not otherwise be admitted to teach or preach publicly or privately. The same act directed the governor and his council to enforce the law rigidly against all nonconformists, compelling them to depart the colony with all convenience. All right? Particularly, these clergymen turned against the Quakers and the Pilgrims and all the others, and the legislative authorities described them as people who were unreasonable and turbulent sort of people who, contrary to the laws, daily gathered assemblies and congregations of people teaching and publishing lies, false visions, prophecies, and doctrines tending to destroy religion, laws, communities, and all bonds of civil society. Fact is, captains of ships were fined £100 sterling for bringing any non-English, non-member of the Church of England into the state of Virginia, for example. And all Quakers, if you were discovered in the state of Virginia, remember, I'm bringing Virginia as the example because guess who came from Virginia? Thomas Jefferson, all right? And Thomas Jefferson, part of what he was writing about in promoting some of the things that he did in the Bill of Rights and things like that were in response to these things. But all Quakers and others who were not members of the Church of England were imprisoned without bail by the forces of England. Persecution also raged against the Baptists. The first Baptists came to Virginia in 1714, 50 years later. On the eve of Revolutionary War, they were relatively numerous, but they consistently ran into trouble with the clergymen of the Church of England. Fact is, this is an interesting story. Three men in January of 1768, John Waller, Lewis Craig, James Childs, were arrested in Virginia. These men were charged before the magistrate with these words: "These men are great disturbers of the peace. They cannot meet a man on the road, but they must ram a text of Scripture down his throat." The magistrates offered to let them go if they would consent not to preach in that county for a year and a day. They refused. And they were marched down the streets of Fredericksburg to jail. Then a trial was held. At that trial, Patrick Henry came. And Patrick Henry rode 50 miles to defend them, and his oratory was described as being very sublime, and his theme very dramatic. And he said, and this is recorded for us by history, he said, "These men are charged with what? Preaching the gospel of the Son of God." And he waved the indictment in the air, and he says that the records of the court indicate that the silence became very painful. And then he finally lifted up his head and he says, "Great God! They should be!" And all the charges were dismissed. That was it. That was all that he did. He didn't do anything else. But here's Patrick Henry, one of the men who helped form the framework of our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution and all of that. And in spite of opposition from the English clergy, the nonconformists continued to increase. They grew more and more in favor with the colonists, because the colonists were seeing the established church as being very distasteful. In fact, this is my guess, but this may be the source of why some historians can look at the writings of some of our founding fathers and say they didn't like Christianity. Well, it may be because they didn't like the established church, and they were trying to get people to go to the Bible instead. Because they liked the Bible, but they didn't like the established church. And that's true. And it's interesting how two different things... I don't know if I've told you this or not. I've told a couple of people. But I went to the bookstore a couple weeks ago when Borders started having their going out of business sale. And it was still too expensive, and now the books are gone, and I should have bought them. But there were two books side by side. One was published, they had almost identical covers. There were pictures of the founding fathers on the cover. And they were both about the same size. One was published in 1 year, I think it was 2009 or something like that. The other one was published in 2010. The first book said, "We're looking at the founding fathers. We're looking at, for the founding fathers." And they looked at George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. And he said, using their own documents and their own words, "We can prove the case that these men believed in God and sought to be Christians in their actions and in their thinking." The second book, same size, almost identical picture on the front, says, "We're looking at the founding fathers, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington, and with their own words, we can prove that these men did not believe in Christianity." Now, you've got two identical books, almost, quoting the same people with two different conclusions. What they're not picturing is the fact that there was an entity in existence, the Church of England, that was hand in hand with the government of England, that was corrupt, that was controlling, that was absolutely against people learning for themselves. And so by the time of the Revolutionary War, two-thirds of the people favored in the colonies the dissenters, the people who were trying to worship in contrast to the clergy of the Anglican Church. And yet, all of these colony citizens, colonial citizens, were still forced by law to pay the Church of England and its clergy. The people complained bitterly, but to little avail. They introduced a bill for religious freedom, but that got turned down. That got, by the way, that bill for religious freedom actually got introduced into to the people who were framing our Constitution after the War of Independence. And Thomas Jefferson in 1801 led to the passing of something called the Bill for Religious Freedom in 1801. And that was part of what was behind the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. We will no longer have a church and state union where the state tells the church what to do, and through the force of religious belief forces people to behave a certain way under penalty of law. That's what was going on. And so that's one of the things that was happening. That's why the clergy were tied to government. And when England was defeated, almost all of the Anglican clergy went back to England. And suddenly, from being the most numerous religious group in the Americas, it became the least number in terms of preachers who advocated, or clergy who advocated it. By the way, that was when you began to have people called preachers instead of clergy. Was in an effort to make a distinction between the Church of England and the arrogant way of thinking and the way of thinking that they did. So anyway, there was all kinds of things that were going on, and the fires of liberty burned fiercely in the hearts of the colonists, the history books say, and the clergy looked on to the English crown for its orders and for protection, and there were all kinds of things going on. And one of the questions that came up that was a big bother in the first century, in this time period, was that of ordaining preachers. And that was an inescapable problem. Because you see, the idea that prevailed was that a man could not preach funerals, he could not preach from a pulpit, he could not baptize, he could not perform a marriage unless he was duly ordained. Now, today, to be ordained means to be recognized by a local group as being chosen and appointed by that group to serve in a particular capacity. That's the legal definition. By the legal definition, I've been ordained. The elders or the men of a particular congregation ask me to serve with them in a certain capacity, that's sufficient to be considered an ordination. Now, some religious groups still have this thinking, though, that goes all the way back. And what they had was the idea that no preacher could be ordained unless he was ordained by a duly ordained minister, who himself was ordained by a duly ordained minister, who went back, all the way back, to the apostolic era. In other words, someone could only be ordained to be a minister who himself had been ordained all the way back to one of the apostles. So it'd be like this. We read about, and usually the ceremony involved the ritual of laying on of hands. And they would point to people like Timothy. Paul laid his hands on Timothy and set him aside for work. And that means that Paul ordained Timothy. Now, Timothy has the power to ordain someone. Timothy ordained someone. He ordained someone. He ordained someone. He ordained someone. And there's supposed to be this unbroken line all the way down to today. Well, what happens when all, and see, when the Church of England split from the Roman Catholic Church, no big deal because there was already people ordained by the Catholic Church in the Church of England. So they continued, you know, the unbroken line, quote unquote, of succession, of passing it on. But what happens when all suddenly in the United States, all of the Anglican preachers are gone? Who can ordain someone? And by the close of the American Revolution, the English clergy had fled back to England, and the colonies were left far short of preachers. And what do we do? And that began to be one of the things that became a pivotal role in this thinking that led to Christianity restoration movement, the movement. Fact is, it really caused people to begin looking at human creeds. And they said, you know, what we've been thinking about is our human creeds of conduct and practical application of the biblical principles are the authority that we have been acting upon, and we've given them more authority than the Bible. And one of those aspects of the creeds had to do with ordination, that word is hard to say, ordaining preachers, okay? And so what was really bad is that this creedalism ruled with a rod of iron. To be a member of a church, you had to swear loyalty to the creed of that church. And even though the Church of England wasn't there, this way of thinking was. And people who had been ordained, you know, and decided to leave the English church, you know, they continued to pass on ordination. But they did it with an idea that says, you know, Akel, if you wanted to be a preacher, you've got to swear that you will uphold loyalty to this creed before I will ordain you, assuming that I'm okay to ordain you. That kept people in control, see? Well, each minister was trained in the creeds. Each minister preached from the creeds. Each minister was sent to maintain its control over the masses. The Bible was a neglected treasure. Creeds destroyed any hopes of unity. It had to be destroyed in order to restore that unity. So shortly after the American Revolution, people began to form movements where they said, you know, there shouldn't be any creeds that we follow. We should follow only the Bible. The Bible should be our rule of order. And a preacher's authority comes not from some man laying hands upon him, but from whether or not he preaches from the Word of God. And sure enough, there began to be some movements. Now, the most famous of the movements are the Campbell and Stone movements, and we'll talk about them. But there was actually some that predated these men in restoring New Testament Christianity. And it was the religious freedom that this country allowed to begin practice, where it allowed anyone with a Bible to search the Scriptures for themselves and obey them to the best of their own conscience, that allowed the restoration movement to begin. Now, what we're going to do from this point on is we're going to take a moment. I mean, we're going to take time and we're going to look at some famous people that lived in the colonies who helped bring about some of the ways of thinking that we take really for granted today. And the first one we're going to look at is a man by the name of James O'Kelly. But we'll look at him next week. Just wanted to give you his name. He is an Irishman. And he is an Irishman who came over and decided, you know, I don't like this creed stuff. He lived in North Carolina, and we're gonna see some things about him and some others next week. But I think you begin to see just how much we owe to the American Revolution and the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence and how all of that really was the catalyst that began to let people go back to the Bible and just simply seek to be Christians only. Christians only. I think it's interesting that it was when people began to go and read the Bible for themselves that they began to see that God had called the church into being in to behave in such a way that people looked at it and they could say, the church isn't behaving like the church ought to be. And they said, you know, the answer has to be God's way of looking at things. It has to be God doing things. I'm not sure how to turn that off. Whatever. It's not going to turn off. Well, I'll turn it off in a minute. Anyway. So we hold a debt of gratitude to our founding fathers, and we hold a debt of gratitude to people who were brave enough to say, God gave us His Word, we can go to it. This evening, if we can be of encouragement, we want to encourage one another to be students of this Word so that we don't make the mistakes that were made in the past, but we have that, we can capitalize on that freedom that our country was founded upon. While together we stand and sing.